Next case of the morning is number 2150360, Amavi versus Paxton and Plucker v. Board of Regents. We'll hear first from Mr. Abrams.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court, Michael Abrams for the appellant. In Soule v. Weiner, the Supreme Court said that plaintiffs are not prevailing parties based on a preliminary injunction undone by a final judgment in the same case. In Dearmore, this Court recognized an exception. Plaintiffs can recover fees when a preliminary injunction causes a defendant to moot the case. Dearmore is not a perfect fit to these facts and should not apply here. But even if it is relevant here, it does not help the plaintiffs. The district court's injunction did not lead to the passage of House Bill 793. And the injunction did not cause the only defendant sued for fees, the Texas Attorney General, to moot the case. And so the judgment below should be reversed.
Counsel, I'm a little puzzled as to why you think Dearmore doesn't apply here. It seems very close to the same scenario, except the distinction on the third prong, which is arguably here there is less evidence of direct causal link between the mootness and the preliminary injunction. So just why are you resisting the idea that Dearmore is the applicable rule of law?
A couple of points, Your Honor. First, I think...
Because you agree with Judge Pittman, right?
To what extent, Your Honor?
He found Dearmore didn't apply perfectly either, right?
I agree with that, Your Honor.
That's what I mean.
He did find that. And I think, Your Honor, in Dearmore, the court said it was applying that rule to specific facts. And then in Davis, it found it persuasive but not binding.
I find all that very confusing, to be honest with you. If the facts aren't exactly like the test that was developed in Dearmore, the test doesn't apply at all.
Well, I think if the plaintiffs don't meet the facts in Dearmore, then you shift back to the general rule that Soule recognized, which is that in general, a preliminary injunction is insufficient. And as further support for that, I'd point to two different, well, one judge, Judge Oldham in his concurrence and Thomas v. Reeves pointed that out. I'd also point to the Sixth Circuit in McCreary versus Conway, which we cite at page 24 of our brief, which notes that as a general matter, a preliminary injunction is insufficient. So I think...
Well, I know, but Soule specifically left the question open, didn't it?
That's true, Your Honor. But I think Soule is relevant here factually in the sense that the plaintiff achieved something in Soule that was significant to her. You know, she was able, after the preliminary injunction, to display her peace symbol at the park, notwithstanding that the court the ordinance would have said otherwise. So that was something that was significant to her, but the court still described that as a transient victory that didn't entitle her to fees. And I think the same thing is true here. The plaintiffs didn't just seek preliminary relief to enjoin House Bill 89. They wanted permanent injunctive relief that would bar the enforcement of it anywhere. So I think Soule still, I agree, Your Honor, that it carved out an exception,
It
didn't address it, but, you know, that's the difficult thing here, frankly, Your Honor, is that there's no binding Supreme Court guidance on this question. The most we have is that we know a consent decree is sufficient, and we know a final judgment is sufficient, but we don't know from the Supreme Court whether, in the absence of that, a preliminary injunction is sufficient.
Well, they claim that... Eight or nine other circuits say that a preliminary injunction may be sufficient.
Yes, I want to go to those cases. So the Fourth Circuit says pretty categorically it's insufficient. The Sixth Circuit, McCreary versus Conway, said as a general matter, a preliminary injunction is insufficient, and then redirected the district court to look for the circumstances where it would be sufficient. There are other cases, so the Third Circuit, for example, People Against Police Violence, just said inappropriate circumstances. And in that case, the injunction had been in effect for 2 years, whereas here we had an immediate appeal and stay within a month of the injunction's
issuance. So what you're
issuance.
Really talking about is The other circuits may or may not have found circumstances where a preliminary injunction effected such a change in the party's legal relationship that it appeared that the plaintiff had prevailed. So we're really talking about causation, right?
That's correct, and that's where it gets to something else that's really tricky, which is that Buchanan says we can't rely on a catalyst theory, that the lawsuit itself can't have caused the change in the party's relationship. And here, you know, and that's why it's tricky, and that we referenced at the beginning, Judge Duncan, it's tricky to apply Dearmore to a legislature because, you know, it's difficult to ascertain what a legislature collectively is thinking. In City of Garland, it was relatively easy to do that because the city essentially admitted, you know, we're changing this because of the injunction. Here, you know, this lawsuit was filed in December. Next January, right as the legislature starts, before the court has even held a hearing on the injunction, Representative King introduces a bill. The House of Representatives passes this bill by a 105-0 vote 2 weeks before the injunction issues. And so if we're in this world where we're trying to ascertain whether the injunction caused the Texas legislature to moot the case, and it's a very difficult showing, given what the legislature had done before the injunction issued.
Just to be clear, though, part of your argument, maybe it's in the alternative, is that the facts here don't meet the third prong of Dearmore, because there is very weak evidence, I think you're arguing, of a causal link between the preliminary injunction and the mootness. Or the change in the law that caused the mootness.
That is correct, Your Honor. If we're in, you know, sort of taking the approach that Davis did, which said, well, yeah, it's a unique fact pattern. Let's look at the Dearmore factors.
Well, I'm trying to take the approach where I read our precedents and apply them, no matter whether I think they're right or not.
That's fair, Judge Duncan. I think that is our argument, though. And I think to that point, Judge Duncan, it also raises the question or begs the question of who has the burden of proof. In Pettaway versus Henry, this court recognized that plaintiffs bear the burden of proof of showing that they are prevailing parties. And so here, I think the district court didn't do any, if the court is applying Dearmore and is looking for some causal link, the district court didn't make any findings in that regard. There were no findings that it was the injunction that caused the defendant to moot the case. Instead, it was just the district court looked to the fact that the injunction was issued April 25th, the Senate passed the bill May 2nd, governor signed it May 7th, so, you know, that causal link, you know, the fact that one followed the other was sufficient. But I think that as the district court recognized, Judge Pittman noted, this isn't quite on all fours with Dearmore as it was there, or with Davis. I mean, the court did ascertain in Davis that the third factor was met, because in Davis, the legislature essentially adopted the district court's maps. And so, you know, I think that the simplest way to resolve this case is to acknowledge that as a general matter, Sol supplies the relevant rule. To the extent that we're applying Dearmore, they don't meet the Dearmore factors on causation. And there's also, if we're following Dearmore exactly, it said causes the defendant. And the attorney general is not the defendant here. Or the attorney general, sorry, was not the one who mooted the case. That was the Texas legislature, as this court recognized in the first appeal of this case. And so for all those reasons, it's a little difficult to track it exactly with Dearmore. But if we're assuming Dearmore applies, we'd argue they don't meet that test.
Well, let's assume it doesn't, and there's some other test, Pettaway or Marshall or something like that. Why didn't the preliminary injunction materially alter the legal relationship between the parties? And I know you might want to say, oh, but it's only Paxton. Okay, you can try to defend that. But surely it all altered the legal relationship between the school districts, didn't it?
I would argue the injunction certainly did some work. I mean, it was a broad facial injunction. But so did the injunction in Seoul. I mean, the injunction in Seoul materially altered that relationship, and that was insufficient,
too. They got to have the peace symbol, at least for one day, yeah. Right?
That's right. And so I also wanted to discuss Marshall and Murphy, which are two cases that the plaintiffs rely on. And I think those cases are distinguishable because in those two cases, the plaintiffs got everything that they wanted. So those were two high school seniors who wanted, in one case, to play football for the rest of the semester, the other just not to be expelled. And In both those circumstances, the passage of time mooted the case, and they got everything they wanted. And again, that's distinguishable here because the plaintiffs didn't just want to temporarily enjoin House Bill 89. And we know that because they eventually moved for permanent declaratory and injunctive relief, and that was ultimately denied as moot. And so we know that they didn't obtain everything that they wanted. And again, that's similar to McCreary versus Conway, which we cite in our brief. And I just note, eventually the Sixth Circuit affirmed the denial of fees in that case.
Well, in this case, the plaintiffs didn't obtain everything they sued for or that the preliminary injunction gave them, correct?
I think so.
It tried to, because the court enjoined the entire statute, right?
That is correct. It was a broad, notwithstanding, of course, that we objected to that, but that was what the injunction did, and the injunction was stayed. And they fought that, and they fought that the case should have been dismissed as moot, and they did not prevail on that either. And so I think that that puts it in a very, very different category. I would submit it's closer to Soul than to anything else. I did just want to note, too, there's a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. Wanted to just raise that briefly. I think that the simplest or easiest way to resolve that is to say that under Rule 4A2, our notice of appeal related forward to the entry of the final judgment dismissing the, or granting the motion for attorney's fees. It was the district court's issued a thorough, comprehensive order setting out exactly what the parties were supposed to do, and just left the math to the parties to do. I think because it's a busy district court, it's fair to just ask the parties to put a proposed order together. And I would submit that any objections that the parties could have raised on that front to how the math should be conducted wouldn't have been reasonable under the circumstances. And so for that reason, I think it makes sense for our notice of appeal to relate forward to the eventual order granting fees. And if there are no further questions, I would reserve my time and ask the court to reverse.
Why don't you explain a little more in more detail why a fee award against Paxton will not suffice here?
Sure, and that's tracking the third prong of Dearmore, which said that the injunction has to cause the defendant to moot the case. And in Amawi versus Paxton, the court noted that it was House Bill 793 that did it. And
As I understand the way the law would have worked, these plaintiffs could have sued the school districts alone, contending that the school districts were denying them something because of an unconstitutional state law. Didn't have to enjoin Paxton, right? But in such circumstances, I think federal and state law require that the Secretary of State or whoever it is to be made a party, right?
I would agree that they didn't have to sue the Attorney General. They sued the Attorney General, I think, because at that point the court's ex parte Young jurisprudence wasn't quite as clear as the city of Austin versus Paxton hadn't yet issued. And the Attorney General does have enforcement authority over the divestment portion of the Boycott Israel Bill, which is a separate portion of the bill, of the law. But the Attorney General does not have any, did not have any contracts with these plaintiffs. And so he did not need to be sued as a party. I think that if we had moved for dismissal on that, against him on that basis, we would have then sought to intervene as the Attorney General anyway to defend the constitutionality of the statute. So I think there had to be some state presence in the case to defend the law. But he did not have any contracts with any of these five plaintiffs.
But that's your argument, that's a principal part of your argument why attorney's fees are not justifiable against Paxton.
That's correct, Your Honor. I don't think that you can attribute any change in conduct to the Attorney General because he did not have contracts with these folks, so there was nothing in their relationship with him that changed. And I think that's our primary point there. And also in terms of when courts vacate judgments or look at Munsingware vacatur, you don't attribute the actions of the executive or the legislature to the executive when the executive has been sued. And I think a similar principle applies here in terms of fees.
But you don't have any case that's on point about that, right?
No, Your Honor. I think that's because most of these cases involve municipalities. City of Dearmore versus City of Garland, some of the cases from the Sixth Circuit, Ninth Circuit. So this is admittedly a unique fact pattern. The court dealt with a similarly unique fact pattern in Davis and applied Dearmore to the extent it could and determined they weren't prevailing parties. And
well, Davis was the interim redistricting plan, right?
That's correct, Your
Well,
Honor.
That's not at all relevant here in my view.
But well, I think it's relevant just in the sense that the court was looking to Dearmore but didn't view it as binding, but viewed it as helpful.
Well, Dearmore is supposed to be relying on Buchanan, right?
Well, I think Dearmore, and may I answer the
sure.
question? I think Dearmore was trying to avoid applying Buchanan because we know that...
I was on the panel.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the court was trying to avoid Buchanan.
Perhaps I was sleeping. But normally I don't try to avoid Supreme Court decisions.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Mr. Sadowski.
Thank you. May it please the court. Justin Sadowski for Appellee Bahia Maui. I want to start out by correcting a few things that I think might have gone awry in the appellate's argument. One is that Sole did not hold that ordinarily preliminary injunction doesn't entitle to relief. Sole held that if there's a preliminary injunction that gets reversed on the merits, the preliminary injunction can't entitle you to relief because one of the tests for being a prevailing party is that the relief you obtain be on the merits. It was explicitly silent as to the question that Texas is the issue that Texas ascribes it to holding. The second thing I want to correct is there's another anti-BDS case currently before the Fifth Circuit called A&R Engineering versus Paxton. In that case, contrary to what the appellant argued, the Texas Attorney General is taking the specific position that it has the authority today that in the absence of the preliminary injunction that Judge Hannon issued in that case to file in state court to invalidate a contract issued in violation of the anti-BDS law.
He didn't say they didn't have authority to do that. He said they hadn't indicated an intention to enforce at that time.
Well, I misheard because I thought he said that they had no authority over it.
Let's just say what you just said is right, and we can go look and see what the AG's position is in that case. Under our decision in City of Austin versus Paxton, the fact that the Attorney General could file a lawsuit doesn't make him a proper defendant for ex parte Young purposes, does it?
I think, to be fair, I think that is exactly what the appellee A&R argued in response. So yes, I don't.
So think he's not an ex parte Young defendant.
In this case, I think he's an ex parte Young defendant because he has authority over the cities to prevent them from entering into those contracts. But not necessarily. Once the contract is entered, I think the argument was the AG has no authority based on the language of the anti-BDS law that said that prevents a city from entering into a contract, but not from performing the contract.
Okay.
I want to then now go to Bahia Maui's case. So Bahia Maui on May 1st entered a contract. On April 25th, the government. The PI was issued. On May 1st, Bahia Maui entered into a contract. At that point, she received a benefit that under Marshall is sufficient. And as this court said in Veazey, at that point, the government couldn't undo that by mooting the case. So I don't think for Ms. Maui that you need to reach Dearmore at all. She wins under Marshall alone.
Why didn't she sue for fees against the whatever the school district was?
Because in the case, the school district was passive. They weren't opposing the law. They were taking no position and weren't active. And I think it was just a matter of...
It doesn't matter. She sued him. She prevailed.
I appreciate it. I think
that's your argument.
I think it was a matter of courtesy, whether that courtesy was deserved or not.
That's weird. Because the school district is the one with the contract... So ostensibly, the school district would be the one saying, well, we can or we cannot have a contract with you because of this law. So whether they're passive or not, they're the principal actor. Whereas the attorney general, I don't see the role of the attorney general here such that even if I agreed with you that they prevailed to some extent with respect to their contracts, how did their legal position with respect to the attorney general change as a result of the preliminary injunction?
I think that the attorney general no longer was in the position to prohibit Pflugerville from entering the contract. So Pflugerville wanted to engage with Bahia Maui. She was prevented from because the city wouldn't offer the contract. And my understanding, the city wasn't offered the contract because they were afraid that they would be inviolate of state law, and they were afraid the attorney general had enforcement over the state law if they tried to violate state law.
Okay, so let's assume that I agree with you for purposes of argument on all those points.
Yeah.
That change in legal position lasted for how long with respect to the attorney general? Like 12 days? Because we stay it, didn't we stay it?
Well, appeal? I don't even think the stay is what's relevant. I think the case, once the case became moot, I think that's the relationship. So I don't know when the stay occurred, but I agree that the relevant period is between April 25th, when the PI was entered, and May 6th or 7th. I can't remember the exact date when the law was passed.
That's a relatively short period of time. Let's say I agree with you on everything else. Why isn't that kind of a de minimis alteration of the status of the parties,
because
such that it wouldn't really support prevailing party status?
Because Bahia Maui, at least, was able to enter a contract first. I know her contract isn't in the record, but her contract which she signed on May 1st, was dated April 25th. I had a chance to look at it. It's not in the record, so I don't know if you can rely on that, but I'm just letting you know.
Well, we can't.
Yes.
Okay.
So she was able, but the fact that she signed her contract on May 1st is in the record, and she was able to go back to work. If she had, if the state of Texas had passed the law in 2018 or whenever they passed the law to expire on May 6th of the year the new law was passed, and she brought her lawsuit, she would have been entitled to the relief that she got of a preliminary injunction, even if the court waited until April 25th to rule it, and she would have been able to sign her contract on May 1st. So I don't think you can say that's de minimis.
If the court had stayed his hand pending the legislative session, there's no question you wouldn't be a prevailing party, right?
Yes.
So the only, you are arguing you're a prevailing party despite the fact that your clients knew about this law, for it had been in effect for more than a year when they filed suit. And the legislature immediately stepped in to exclude sole proprietors. And the House had already passed with zero negative votes this exclusion. So what was the point of continuing forcing the injunction hearing, which I believe all the school districts opposed at that time? And didn't your client testify against the legislation?
Yeah. So obviously, Bahia Maui is part of a boycott, and a boycott isn't effective if the boycott is if other people can't participate in the boycott. A boycott is by definition collective action. So Bahia Maui wanted, because she believes in the rights of Palestinians, disagrees with what the state of Israel is doing in Gaza and the West Bank, wanted the ability to participate in this boycott with other people. She argued that in her Fifth Circuit brief after, before the court on why the case was moot, and she did lose on that issue. But that was what she wanted. But just because she lost on that one issue doesn't mean that the relief she did earn was de minimis.
Is, just so I get it straight, is your position also that Dearmore doesn't apply the three-part analysis in that case?
Our position is that Dearmore doesn't apply because Marshall does, but that even if Dearmore applies, that the plaintiffs win.
Okay, how do you meet the third prong of Dearmore, which, as to my eyes, I wasn't on the panel, I didn't write the decision, but to my eyes, it was emphasized throughout that opinion that there has to be a direct causal relationship between the preliminary injunction and the mooting of the case, whereas here, as I understand the timeline, the mooting of the case, the change in the legislation, was on the two-yard line by the time the preliminary injunction issued. Well, so how could it have directly caused it?
Two things, and I only have a minute. But one is that Dearmore purported to rely on all cases, on the decisions of other circuits other than the Fourth Circuit, and no other circuit has that specific requirement of finding some legislative causal intent. And I think the second point that we would make is that that generally, because you can't look at legislative intent, that you would normally would have to presume, and you should presume, that the law was passed in response when it's passed so quickly that there's no benefit obtained other than
But don't you agree that our Davis decision after Dearmore, our Davis decision doesn't support that argument, because our Davis decision does look at the legislative history and say, well, it shows that there was a causal relationship.
I don't think that because it looked at it didn't exclude what would happen in the absence of that legislative history. And I also want to point, finally, at what Judge Pittman said below, and my time's running out, that I don't think it's plausible that if the court had ruled the other way, that the governor would still have signed the law.
Okay.
Mr. Buser.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thomas Buser Clancy, representing the Pluker plaintiffs. Your Honors, I thought I would start with perhaps the discussion of the Attorney General as defendant, unless the court has other questions I'd like to jump to. In that respect, I think that there are a couple of key distinctions that need to be made here. The first is that in Davis, which Judge Shunkin was just talking about, it was also legislative action that mooted out the change, and the legislature was not a named defendant in that case. And yet the court found that with respect to the defendant portion of the third Dearmore factor, that was met. So the Davis court did not draw this distinction.
But the several other Texas executives were defendants, right?
It is true that the governor was a defendant in that case. It's not something that the Davis court spoke of or discussed in any depth. It just said this is a legislative change and referred it to the state of Texas. But I think importantly, though, the state here is pointing the court to a lot of discussions of the court's decisions about vacature. But vacature is an entirely separate inquiry, and it's an equitable inquiry that delves into whether the defendant was at fault for the case becoming moot, and that's how the court determines whether to vacate the decision. And that's why it makes sense to draw the distinction between the Attorney General and the legislature, because that's a question of fault. But here, the question is about whether the plaintiffs prevailed. The question is not what caused the mootness, and I'll get to Dearmore in a second. The question is not what caused the mootness. The central inquiry has to be, did plaintiffs prevail? And plaintiffs can prevail whether or not they cause, or whether or not the defendant causes the mootness. And that's what you can see in this court's decision in Marshall, in Murphy.
That's just contrary to Buckhannon.
Well, Your Honor, I think in Buckhannon,
there has to be a change in the legal relationship.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And that change in the legal
not
relationship,
not just a naked, you know, post hoc propter hoc.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree with that. The plaintiffs must achieve a victory that has judicial imprimatur. There has to be a change in the legal relationship. That is a preliminary injunction that is on the merits. And that it comes from this court's findings. It comes from the vast majority of other circuits to have considered this, is that a preliminary injunction on the merits is sufficient to afford a change in the legal relationship.
So you are, surely you recognize that in Seoul, the Supreme Court said, we're not going to address the question of whether a preliminary injunction that is then mooted will sustain prevailing party status. So doesn't that suggest that we are in a gray area, and it doesn't do to point to some old case from our court and say, okay, we got a preliminary injunction on the merits, therefore we're a prevailing party?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think Seoul disrupted the legal inquiry into prevailing party status to the extent the state makes it out to be. In Seoul, what they said is if you achieve a preliminary injunction, that in the same case is then undone on the merits. In Seoul, there was a summary judgment against.
They lost on the permanent injunction, so that's that situation. I think everybody recognizes that is not on all fours with this situation.
Yes. And every other circuit to have considered Seoul, mm-hmm. post-Seoul, whether a plaintiff can still achieve victory on a preliminary injunction on the merits says yes, that Seoul does not disrupt that. We cite the court to Planned Parenthood, the Sixth Circuit decision that we think is actually reflective of the Sixth Circuit's guidance on this case. And the other case that I would cite the court to that I think is not on all fours with this case, but particularly close, is the Tenth Circuit decision in Kansas Judicial Watch. Because there what happened is that there was a lawsuit against the Kansas Judicial Commission seeking to enjoin some factors that dealt with campaigning as judges. And then the Kansas Supreme Court, they achieved a preliminary injunction on the merits. And then the Kansas Supreme Court, not a named defendant to the action, ultimately changed the rules so as to moot out the case. Despite the fact that the Kansas Supreme Court was a different defendant, was not a defendant, was a third party, and despite the fact, without any look into causation, the court said, achieving a preliminary injunction on the merits in this situation is sufficient to afford the party prevailing party status. And not only is that case, I think, instructive, but I think it's also consistent with this court's overall jurisprudence on what it means to be a prevailing party. In VC, in Davis, in Pettaway, what this court has repeatedly said is that to be a prevailing party requires achieving success on some claim that affords relief, even if that success is pendant-like. Even if that success is not the final judgment, but comes pendant light. That, I think, is the through line that connects Marshall to Murphy, to Dearmore, to Davis,
well,
to VC.
Let me go back. Even if we accepted your, maybe nobody made this argument in the district court, but your clients barely prevailed. In other words, they, quote, ended up, quote, prevailing for their own benefit, but not overturning the law as a whole.
Your Honor, it is correct that the plaintiffs sought to enjoin the law as a whole based on its unconstitutional.
And that's what the preliminary injunction purported to do.
And it did. But it undoubtedly ensured that the law did not apply to the plaintiffs. And that was part of what they sought. And under, I think, the Supreme Court standard in Texas Student Teachers Association, the test is no longer all of the relief. The test is no longer that.
No,
it's rather whether you succeed on a significant claim that affords some relief.
No, but you don't get all your fees when you only prevail on a narrow part of the claim. That's what I'm saying.
Your Honor, here the state has not contested that there should have been a lesser award of fees or something about the fee award. It is only contested whether plaintiffs are prevailing parties. And to the extent that this idea goes to something Judge Duncan raised, which is whether this success is de minimis or technical, as we noted in our briefing to this court, we think that argument is waived. In the district court below, the state never argued that the success achieved by plaintiffs was technical or de minimis, and the court should reject the attempt to insert that argument here.
The question is still one of causation, and in Dearmore, the court makes it plain toward the outset of the discussion that whether a plaintiff qualifies as a prevailing party for PI after the district court makes an unambiguous indication of probable success and defendant subsequently moots the case before trial in direct response to the court's preliminary injunction. Well, that's a pretty tight time frame for causation in Dearmore. And here, what you have is the court forcing the case to trial after two-thirds, or as Judge Duncan says, the legislature was 2 yards from the finish line and therefore couldn't have been acting in direct response to the court's preliminary injunction.
Well, Your Honor, I have two answers to that. The first is that the timeline in Dearmore is actually the exact same timeline here. There are 12 days between the issuance of the preliminary injunction and the action that moots the case out. So to the extent 12 days could
in
potentially...
In the span of a five-month legislative process.
Yes, Your Honor. But my second response to that would be to push back a little bit on this idea that it was inevitable that this bill was going to pass. And I think this is exactly what Buckhannon warns against, is to trying to ascertain the motivations of the legislature and exactly what they were going to do, if not for some other thing. Here, what the timeline shows is, yes, the bill had passed out of the House prior to the preliminary injunction order, but countless bills pass out of one part of the legislature and never become law. And it had gone to Senate committee, but it had stalled in Senate committee. It had not passed out of the Senate committee. They had an opportunity to pass it out.
Do you have any evidence? Do you have any evidence beyond what we know as the timeline that there was any doubt about whether the law would pass?
Your Honor, I think both the state and plaintiffs here are discussing the timeline. And part of the reason is that Buckhannon says we can't inquire into subjective motivations, which is why we would respectfully state that the court should clarify the third Dearmore factor about causation, because that third Dearmore factor would require, if you're really going to look into, is this a but-for cause or not,
well,
would require looking into.
I mean,
sorry, Your Honor.
There was dispute about that in the district court, because as I understand it, the attorney general didn't ask for the PI hearing to be delayed, but the school districts did. And they say, why are you costing us all this money for a preliminary injunction, when it looks as if, and school districts certainly have a pretty good eye on the legislative process.
Yes, Your Honor, may I answer?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I would give you the same answer that we gave the district court in opposing pushing back the preliminary injunction, which is that it was purely speculative what the Senate was going to do with the bill if not for the preliminary injunction issuing. They could have decided not to move it entirely, as it was waiting in committee. They also could have amended it in a way that no longer affected our clients. The fact that none of those occurred after the preliminary injunction issued does not mean that in the hypothetical world where the preliminary injunction does not issue, a different course of events would have taken place. I think that's the speculation that Buckhannon warned against, which is why we would purport that this court should clarify the third Dearmore factor to be more about, as the state says, whether you prevail or not, it's often a question of timing. And if the mootness comes after the preliminary injunction on the merits.
You're going way beyond.
I apologize.
That's okay. Thank you. All right, Mr. Abrams.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start with a two-yard line analogy because I think it's appropriate here. The Texas legislative session started in January of 2019. And the deadline to submit bills was in March of that year. So the idea that the legislature could have amended House Bill 89 or mooted this case because of the injunction just doesn't track the legislative process. There would have been no time to introduce a bill, get it through both houses with sufficient time by that point. So the fact that it had passed 105 by vote, a veto-proof majority, 105-0, 2 weeks before the district court issued the injunction, it's hard to think of stronger evidence that the injunction itself did not cause the legislature to moot the case, which means that the plaintiffs can't meet the Dearmore standard if that is how the court is approaching this case. I also want to address my friends on the other side addressed a case that's currently pending in this court and what our position is there. I'm not on that case, and I don't want to take any position on what we're saying now. I'm just saying in 2019, we did not take the position that we were going to enforce House Bill 89 with respect to any of these plaintiffs and their contracts. So I don't know, what the current circumstances of that lawsuit is. I believe the briefing is still ongoing, but that was our position in 2019. I also want to address VC, which is perhaps this court's most recent precedent dealing with Dearmore. And the way that VC rejected the state's arguments there was to address the fact that that case involved actual success on the merits. So that was the voter ID bill after there was a final trial, permanent injunction, en banc sitting of this court, and two elections held under relief that the court, the en banc court, ordered. So I think that's much different than the sort of transient relief, to use Sol's language, that you have here in this case. I'd also return to the question of whether Marshall applies and whether the plaintiff Amawi received everything she wanted by referencing the fact that the day that the governor signed House Bill 89, she moved for a permanent injunction. She knew that the preliminary injunction didn't give her everything that she wanted. Otherwise, she would have, you know, that would have been sufficient. But she wanted permanent declaratory and injunctive relief, and so did the other plaintiffs. And they didn't obtain that. Finally, I note with respect to Davis, the court did say, well, you know, that factor is met because the legislature changed the maps in response to the court's order. But the parties didn't appear to raise that issue. I read through the state's brief before this, before our argument today, and I didn't see that reference, that third prong of Davis or Dearmore feature prominently in the party's briefing. So I think this court would still have some leeway to distinguish Davis, because we don't presume that, you know, the court has rendered, you know, a decision on something that wasn't really raised by that case. And as my friend on the other side noted, Davis didn't really address that issue in much depth. And so I think, you know, regardless of what rule applies here, whether it's a general rule that preliminary injunctions do not entitle a plaintiff to fees, or if we're looking under Dearmore and we find that the cause...
Well, to be clear, we couldn't say that, could we, as a panel?
I think
the en banc court could say that.
That's correct.
This, we can't.
That's correct, Judge Duncan. This court can't say that preliminary injunctions are never sufficient, because Dearmore makes clear that there are circumstances where it is. We just argue that should be a narrow circumstance rather than the general rule. Right. And to the extent we're looking at that, it doesn't apply here. And if there are no further questions, we would ask the court to reverse the judgment below.
Okay, thank you very much.